Hey everybody, welcome back. As promised, today I'm going to talk about the death of Christ on the cross when he said, "It is finished," and offer my interpretation for the significance of that pronouncement. I'm going to take as the text for this exploration Matthew chapter 27. And I'm going to start somewhere in verse 17. Actually, let's take a step back to 16. And they, this is a crowd, had then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, "Whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ?" Kind of like saying, this man with long hair who is called a rock star. Think of it in those terms, that formulation. This is Pilate speaking. For he knew that for envy they had delivered him, they being the cultural elite, the gatekeepers of the crowd, who pegged Jesus, this long-haired rock star of religion, as a mortal threat. When he was sat down on the judgment seat, his wife, so we're talking about Pilate's life here. His wife sent unto him, saying, "Have thou nothing to do with that just man? For I have suffered many things this day in a dream." So it's like Deus ex machina talking to her, telling her that this pseudo rock star is fated for something great, so you better change course, Mr. Pilate, because of him. But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said unto them, "Whether of the twain," don't you just love the King James, "will ye that I release unto you?" They said, because they're sheep, "Barabbas." Pilate saith unto them, "What shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ?" They all say unto him, you know, this person came to you with words, called himself a poet, called himself the liberator of the Jews. "What shall I do with him then? Let him be crucified." And the governor said, "Why, what evil hath he done?" But they cried out the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." And here in this crucified, this verb, here in that, because it is what it is, here in that, let him be shunned from society, nailed and anchored to a point of destitution, and made to rot in agony. The ultimate outcast. That's what someone who was hanged on a cross was. They were a symbol of Rome's authority over and domination over a people group. Anyone who fell out of line was crucified. And I don't need to begin to outline the parallels in every society that the cross has. And the governor said, "Why? What evil hath he done?" But they cried out the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." It just wouldn't stop. When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands, like God, in the beginning of creation, separating the waters from the waters. It's an ironic move here that the writer's making, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See ye to it." Then answered all the people and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." Again, that's a double use of irony, just as in the time of Egypt, which is an exact parallel to this people group's time in Rome under domination from an alien governor, an alien strength. They were liberated by the mighty arm, an invisible arm. I think today, as capitalists, we would call it the invisible arm of the saving market, the thing that picks out talent or potential and maximizes it to someone's success. That was the hand that would go and take the firstborn of every house, you know, the future of every house, and except for those that had blood marked on the doorposts as a symbol, as a sign of this one is safe, pass over it. And the name of the Passover came to be. This house is already ordered. This house has a future. There is life inside, life worth protecting. A separation that is for the good. It's like a strand of DNA that is radicalized, and it will add to, not subtract from, human fulfillment. Okay, so a lot of different interpretations of sacred narrative. Let's skip ahead to after they spit on him, after they beat him up, after they gave him the crown of thorns. Let's zero in on his time on the cross. All right, here's a good place. The chief priests were mocking him, and the scribes and elders too, saying to the crowds which had followed them to the hill that Jesus was hanging on, like an albatross, like a fallen star, naked and nailed to the wood, they said, inciting the crowd, "He saved others. Himself he cannot save. If he be the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him." See, they were being demagogues and playing on the people's deep desire for salvation. But what they were feeding them was rubbish in the form of a straw man. So instead of Jesus on the cross, that was a symbolic and physical sacrifice of a goat or sheep instead of someone's firstborn, playing the role of the Savior. They were expecting some warrior figure, some stolen icon from the mythology of the Romans, which was itself stolen from the Greeks. Quite ironic in that regard. Many layers to the movement on the cross. So these people had in their semi-consciousness an idea of a knight in shining armor on a white horse coming and liberating them all with his sword dipped in blood, like their Isaiah the prophet wrote. And the scribes, who didn't like Jesus because he was taking the crowd's attention away from them, siphoning off the pie chart of attention, they were using that wish, that hope, against the people, pointing at this naked figure on the cross and saying, surely he's not the knight in shining armor. But I'm going to borrow from my favorite philosopher and theologian and psychologist, Soren Kierkegaard, that's Kierkegaard, lived in the 1800s. He was a rock star of the mind. I could go on and on for days about him. He's my favorite person in the world. No longer with us, alas. Anyway, he would say that he loved paradoxes, and he thought the incarnation, he thought through the incarnation, the logos, the word, the brand, the symbol becoming fleshly in time and space, and living for a certain period, and then dying, as a paradox, as two opposites that cannot be reconciled, but that do come close together and emit sparks. And for him, that was the highest, that rising of the spark was the highest attainment a believer could have. And that for him was the nourishing fire of faith. The thing that could move mountains was, in Kierkegaardian terms, one's openness to and tolerance for paradoxes. All right? I happen to believe him. I have the temperament to believe him, though, as well. It's not for everybody. Probably. I mean, if you're going to build a plane, You shouldn't put all your stock and trade in paradoxes. You need to follow the math wherever it goes. It's important. At any rate, back to the cross. So if Soren was in the crowd, he'd look up to Christ on the tree and he'd say, "No, no, no, you elders and scribes, you've got it all wrong. This man gasping before us and dying, he is in fact our white knight, our shining armored God, who will liberate us all and destroy and trample underfoot the Roman Empire. Don't you see it?" And the people would look at Soren and want to crucify him as well. They will already have crucified him with their eyes, because in their mind, their group mind, their herd mentality, he is as far away from them as Christ is up on the cross. Very important. Because he said a strange thing, comparing this dying figure on a tree to an industrious knight. It'd be like saying the janitor mopping the floor is equal to, and not just equal to in number, but actually the embodiment of the entrepreneur we're all waiting for to save the economy, to give us jobs, to inspire us to take our own next step forward. They're one and the same. On an economic plane, it's a similar move. And Kierkegaard would say it's absolutely true. Not in the sense of factually true, but in the sense of the two paradoxes coming close together actually represent a higher truth than either one of them individually. The individual life of the janitor, or the individual life of a Jeff Bezos, the individual life of a knight in shining armor, Roman warrior, or Luke Skywalker type in modern language, or the dying, naked, Adam-like man on a cross, cursed. You know, the lowliest of the low. It'd be like a worm inching its way up to the pearly gates and finding a throne there. Crazy stuff. But Kierkegaard said, you know, something about that collision is higher than the reality of either one. So he would try to convince these people to know the present era you're in, know the moment that you're standing on. This is what you've been waiting for. This is what you've been asking for. You just, even though you can't see it, you need to believe it. And that's where faith comes in, faith aiding the physical eyes. Most people won't listen to Soren, as most people won't listen to Christ, as most people don't follow into the dark to shine light on the unknown so that they can add the unknown to their known categories. So the scribes and the Pharisees won, and Jesus was left with the final word, and he cried out with a loud voice saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is to say, thank God the writer did this for me, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Now that's a reference to an older psalm. He's actually quoting back to this crowd a song, and he's telling them, "I'm about to be crushed. I'm about to be destroyed. Goodbye, farewell. The neck broken, the sacrifice offered up." Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, "This man calleth for Elijah." And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. The rest said, "Let be. Let us see whether Elijah will come to save him." People were curious, because at this moment, the man, the being, the human, transferred in their mind from a living, breathing organism, a fellow creature, to a spectacle, to an event. Very important progress that some people go through in their lives. They go from the friend, the family member, to a spectacle. And when you're in that spectacle mode, you're only one breath away from the symbolic, which is where Christ is heading. Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost, a euphemism for dying. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain, no more separation anymore. An irony. So in dying, the two became twain. In the ultimate sacrifice, the ultimate commitment, giving up your life for the higher ideal, the ideal comes down to you. Transcendence touches ground. The veil is torn, no more separation. It was a great gift. that this rock star yielded on the cross. And behold, the graves were opened, immediate immortality, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose, mass enthusiasm, and memories were rekindled. New stories were told. A lot happened here. The death was a fertilizer. And came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. Now I'm going to stop there. Magnificent. Magnificent. Movement. I mean, that is the story of life. You plant a seed, you wait. The seed breaks, and out comes the tendrils, which becomes a stalk, which becomes a branch, which becomes fruit for future generations. But nothing in the future comes without sacrifice. And sacrifice is just a fancy archaic word for commitment. And commitment simply means delaying present success or gratification because of the future possibility. Christ was misunderstood on the cross. You could have a million Soren Kierkegaards pleading his case before the massive crowd, and it wouldn't and shouldn't make one iota of difference, because that last breath, the ghost rising from the wood, signified the ultimate commitment of time and space and life for future growth of time and space and life for many generations, many fruits, many seeds, many stories. It's like, it's a beautiful story. And it was what, less than 12 sentences long? Beautiful, beautiful. And that's why to this day it lives on. Even when people don't go to church, this, the sustenance from this branch of spirit, of thinking, of seeing, exists in them. All right. Enough musing. You have a wonderful day, and tomorrow is Saturday. I think I need to be a little more systematic and go through something from beginning to end. I don't know yet what that will be. Maybe I'll do some psalms first to work up some energy for the marathon run of a book. Or maybe I'll do some Carl Jung stuff. I don't know. I definitely want to talk about migrations, the original mythology I'm working on. But that's not right away. That will come in time. Bye-bye.